Chapter 14. Annus Horribilis. On September 1, 2004, Putin was in Sochi on the Black Sea, trying not very successfully to spend the waning days of the country's traditional August holidays in the subtropical climate. By now, he spent more time in the presidential compound there than in any of the Kremlin's other official residences outside Moscow. It was here that he frequently held meetings with foreign leaders, including one the day before with Jacques Chirac of France and Gerhard Schroeder of Germany, the Troika who had publicly opposed the American war in Iraq. Without exactly gloating, they felt their forewarnings of disaster had been affirmed as the swift American toppling of Saddam Hussein's government turned into a deadly insurgency. Putin had grown so close to Schroeder that he expedited the adoption of a Russian orphan for him and his wife. Each leader, finding common cause with Putin against the swaggering policy of George Bush, muted his country's criticism of Russia, including the war in Chechnya. Putin's August vacation had already been disrupted by an ominous string of tragedies. On August 21st, a bold raid by insurgents in Chechnya killed at least 50 people. It followed a similar raid in neighboring Ingushetia in June that had killed nearly 100 and came only days before Chechnya held a new election, which Chirac and Schroeder would praise as evidence that Putin sought a political solution to the conflict, now in its fifth year. Then, on the night of August 24th, two passenger airliners took off from Domodedovo Airport in Moscow, roughly an hour apart. Almost simultaneously, around 11 o'clock, they both exploded in midair, destroyed by suicide bombers, both women. One had paid a bribe of 1,000 rubles to get on one of the planes after boarding had already closed. One plane was headed to Volgograd, the second to Sochi. 89 people died. Sensing the gravity of the attacks, Putin returned to Moscow and ordered the creation of a task force to investigate. But by the weekend, he had returned to Sochi and said nothing more until he appeared with Chirac and Schroeder. He blamed the bombings, the worst terrorist act in the skies over Russia, on Al-Qaeda, which grossly misstated the facts. Only a few hours after he spoke, a woman blew herself up at the entrance to the Rishkaya metro station in Moscow, only 3 miles north of the Kremlin. That attack killed the bomber and 9 others and injured more than 50. The officials who rushed to the scene included Moscow's mayor, Yuri Lushkov, underscoring the panic that was unfolding, not unlike that which had followed the apartment bombings in 1999. The police in Moscow announced that the bomber was Rosa Nageeva, though that later proved false. Her sister, Amanat, was suspected of destroying one of the two airliners. Their roommate, Tsatsitsa Jibarhanova, destroyed the other. The three shared a grim apartment in Grozny's shattered ruins with another woman, Maryam Taburova. They lived steps away from the city's muddied, fetid central market, where they sold clothing they shuttled in from Azerbaijan. On August 22nd, 2 days before the attack on the airliners, the four had all left Grozny and taken a bus to Azerbaijan's capital, Baku. They were now involved in a new wave of terror. The authorities quickly pieced together their trail, but they did not know where Taburova and, as it turned out, Rosa Nageeva had gone. Putin had begun 2004 seemingly at the peak of political power. The parliamentary elections had cemented his control of the legislature, and while the arrest of Khodorkovsky had rattled the stock market, it had not dented his popularity ratings, which hovered above 70%. Even wary investors seemed relieved that the attack on Yukos seemed to be a personal and political fight, not the result of a drive to renationalize industry. "People will forget in 6 months that Khodorkovsky is still sitting in jail," declared William Browder, the director of Hermitage Capital, one of the funds that rode the Putin boom. The effects of an improving economy seemed to proliferate day by day in new stores and restaurants and apartment buildings, especially in Moscow and other cities. oil prices had more than tripled since the fiscal crisis of 1998, and a new tax regime Putin imposed on the oil companies, based, ironically, on proposals drafted by Yukos, poured money into the state's coffers. The share of oil profits the government received had nearly doubled, and revenues had surged from less than $6 billion when Putin became prime minister to more than $80 billion. The Russians now talked about becoming the world's largest oil producer, surpassing Saudi Arabia. The boom was not Putin's success alone, and his critics derided him as lucky, but as the undisputed leader of the country, he reaped the political benefits. In early January, the Kremlin pressed its case against Yukos, announcing that the company owed $3.4 billion in back taxes for the year 2000 alone. Prime Minister Mikhail Kazyanov voiced the lone public protest. In an interview he gave to the newspaper Vyedomosti, he argued that Khodorkovsky and his partners had not cheated on taxes, but simply used loopholes that were then available to everyone, but were now retroactively being declared illegal. Putin took note of his prime minister's defiance, however mild it seemed. Kazyanov was careful never to speak directly against his boss, but the following Saturday, at a regular meeting of his Security Council, Putin asked the members to stay on after the regular agenda had been completed. The council included the country's most important officials, including the ministers of defense and foreign affairs, and, of course, Kazyanov as the prime minister. Putin instructed the prosecutor general, Vladimir Ustinov, to read aloud the charges against Khodorkovsky, all of them, in the belief that the enunciation of Khodorkovsky's crimes would dispel any doubts and refute Kazyanov's dangerous line of questioning before anyone else took it up. Ustinov read the indictments monotonously, page after page, for more than an hour. The Security Council members, not really understanding why this was being done, sat there with stone faces, not moving, Kazyanov recalled. He could not help but smile at all of the absurdities and obvious inventions. Putin, at the head of the long oval table, scanned the faces of his aides, making note of the reactions, the blank, unaffected stares of most, and Kazyanov's grin. When Ustinov finished, no one asked a question or said a word in response, and everyone walked out silently. Putin's political dominance was such that there seemed to be little point in challenging him. Not even in the presidential election, held that March, did he face meaningful opposition. The political titans of the Yeltsin era, Gennady Zyuganov and Vladimir Zhirinovsky, men who had once seemed within reach of ruling all of Russia, pulled out before the official campaign even started. Instead, they assigned party apparatchiks to run token campaigns. In Zhirinovsky's case, his bodyguard, a former boxer named Alek Malishkin, carried the party's banner. Grigory Yavlinsky, so embittered by Yabloko's defeat in December, refused entreaties from the Kremlin itself to mount a third campaign for the presidency, to create the semblance of a democratic choice. When they vacationed together that winter, Boris Nemtsov, another reformer who had served under Yeltsin, tried to persuade Kazyanov to run as the candidate representing the country's economic liberals, but Kazyanov dared not seriously consider challenging his boss. In the weeks before the campaign, a poll found that 55% of respondents thought it would be better to cancel the election and save the money it would cost to hold it. Putin's re-election, the affirmation of the course he had chosen for Russia, seemed on the verge of collapsing, but in a way he and his aides had not expected. The managed democracy that Surkov had orchestrated had succeeded so well that it threatened to undermine Putin's own image as the democrat who had turned Russia around with the assent of the people. One of the first pieces of legislation in the new Duma called for amending the constitution to extend the presidential term to 7 years, allowing Putin to run for 2 new terms. it would have kept him in office until 2018. But he demurred, insisting that there should be no constitutional changes. He still sought a democratic imprimatur, though in a race in which he faced, by the Kremlin's own design, no genuine competition. The Kremlin was left having to recruit its own candidates to oppose him, including Yavlinsky and a former legislator from Petersburg, Sergei Mironov, who accepted the nomination of a small party with an impassioned plea to vote for the incumbent. "When a leader who is trusted goes into battle," he said of Putin, "he must not be left alone." The liberals could not agree on a single candidate now any more than they had been able to unite as a bloc before the parliamentary elections. Irina Hakamada, a Russian of Japanese descent and one of the most prominent women in politics, ended up running a lonely challenge. Her own party, the Union of Right Forces, refused to endorse her. From exile in London, Boris Berezovsky bankrolled another candidate, Ivan Rybkin, a former Duma speaker and Yeltsin ally. He ultimately dropped out, but not before injecting the most drama into the campaign by disappearing for 4 days in February, during which the authorities announced an investigation into his possible murder. When he resurfaced, he vowed to continue his campaign. He then promptly fled to London, where he met Berezovsky's aides, including Alexander Litvinenko, the former FSB officer who had gone public with his accusations against the agency. Litvinenko had fled Russia in October 2000 and settled in London with Berezovsky's financial patronage. Rybkin now claimed that he had been kidnapped and drugged in Kiev, where he had gone on an invitation to meet the head of Chechnya's separatists, Aslan Maskhadov, the former president and now one of Russia's most wanted criminals. The implausibility of Maskhadov risking travel to Ukraine, where Russia's security services were deeply embedded, seemed not to have occurred to Rybkin. Rybkin said he had fallen unconscious for 4 days after having sandwiches and tea in a Kiev apartment. When he came to, two armed Russian men showed him a videotape that he declined to describe in detail, except that it was made by perverts and was meant to humiliate him into silence. Litvinenko claimed the drug Rybkin had ingested was SP-117, a truth serum used by Russia's foreign intelligence services. "Once you get SP-117, they can do whatever they want with you, drive you around, put you in bed with girls or boys, tape you, and so on," he said. "Then you get one pill of antidote and you are normal again and don't remember what happened." No one took Rybkin's accusations seriously, not even his wife, who said she felt sorry for Russia if people like this want to govern it. His political career never recovered. Berezovsky, though, never tired in his campaign to discredit Putin, denouncing him regularly with increasing vehemence and a diminishing regard for the truth. It would not be the last time he and Litvinenko became entangled in a sensational drama involving spies and poison. Putin ignored not only his challengers, he ostensibly ignored his own campaign as he had 4 years before. He did not have to campaign overtly because the Kremlin's control of television meant his duties as president were dutifully and uncritically covered even more prominently on the evening news. Putin's challengers, if they were mentioned at all, were infantilized or denounced. When the first debate among the presidential candidates was held on February 12th, at 8 in the morning, the early hour ensuring the fewest possible viewers, Putin refused to attend. His 29-minute speech that day, officially opening his campaign, however, aired repeatedly through the afternoon and evening. He ran no campaign ads, held no rallies, and offered no clear proposals for a second term, except to continue to be the living embodiment of Russia's stability. The paradox was that, 4 years into Putin's presidency, Russia's stability still seemed precarious, a disaster away from the turmoil of the 1990s that Putin often invoked. On the eve of the race, a bomb exploded at the door of Yelena Tregubova, the journalist Putin had treated to sushi while he was director of the FSB. In 2003, she had published a book on her experiences in the Kremlin's increasingly circumscribed press pool, Tales of a Kremlin Digger. It had been a bestseller, describing in gossipy detail the Kremlin's efforts to manage the pool's reporting, including an incident where Putin scolded a boy who had been hit by a car. "From now on," he told the boy, "you won't be violating traffic regulations anymore." Tregubova assumed the bombing was somehow linked to the coming election. She was not injured, but she was rattled enough that she fled Russia. "It is becoming uncomfortable to live in this city," she said. 4 days later, a suicide bomber blew himself up on a metro train in the center of Moscow, killing 41 and wounding more than 200. One of those accused of organizing it was later involved in the attack at the Rizhskaya metro bombing 6 months later. On February 14th, 2 days after the official start of campaigning, the roof of a popular new indoor water park in southern Moscow collapsed. Transvaal Park symbolized the amenities that Putin's economic boom was bringing to the country's emerging consumer class, an indoor tropical paradise in the frigid north. 28 people died in the disaster, which the building's designers blamed on a terrorist attack, but that was in fact caused by a construction flaw. It was impossible to blame Putin directly for any one of the events, but they were collectively as sure a measure of his rule as the economic successes he happily took credit for. Ivan Rybkin produced a lacerating American-style attack ad that showed the subway and water park disasters, along with the sorry state of education and healthcare, but the state's television network simply refused to broadcast it. Still, Surkov's political team left nothing to chance. The Kremlin issued orders to outlying regions specifying Putin's vote totals and voter turnout. The authorities in Khabarovsk in the Far East threatened to discharge hospital patients if they could not prove they had received absentee ballots to cast their votes. A housing official in St. Petersburg sent a letter to building superintendents ordering them to ensure 70% turnout. Anticipating the Kremlin's wishes, local bureaucrats threw up obstacles to keep Putin's rivals from mounting campaigns at all. The police interrupted one rally in Yekaterinburg on the premise there was a bomb threat. The electricity was cut off at another in Nizhny Novgorod 2 days later. The campaign was so stripped of any electoral interest that the Kremlin's biggest worry now was that voter turnout would fall below the 50% threshold required to make the election legal. Anything below that would force a new election. That would be embarrassment enough, but Putin's closest advisors also began to see the seeds of a conspiracy to deprive him of power. By law, if a new election were required, the prime minister would step in to serve as acting president in the interim. That is, Mikhail Kazyanov. He had criticized the prosecution of Khodorkovsky, who, Putin was convinced, was trying to buy control of the state. He had vacationed with Boris Nemtsov, who had raised the possibility of his running for president, as Putin must surely have found out. The chances of Kazyanov maneuvering into power were infinitesimally remote, but Putin and his aides believed it, and they would not tolerate any risk. At a concert at the Kremlin on February 23rd, Kazyanov himself sensed Putin's coolness. He noticed him during an intermission, whispering in a corner with FSB head Nikolai Patrushev and otherwise avoiding him. The next day, Putin summoned Kazyanov to his Kremlin office alone and fired him. Not only did he not explain why to the public, he refused to tell Kazyanov, who was so stunned by the news that he did not initially understand that Putin meant immediately, not after his re-election in March, when a new prime minister might have been expected. It was Putin's most significant shake-up of his government, whose continuity had been held up as a measure of political stability. And like Yeltsin before him, he used surprise to maximize the impact and keep the media's attention on him. Not even other senior officials knew the move was coming. Putin said only that the voters deserve to know the composition of the new government before the election, which only underscored how predictable he knew the result would be. Putin did not immediately announce Kazyanov's replacement, though, and the delay touched off rampant speculation, not about the election in 3 weeks, but about the one in 2008 that would elect Putin's successor after he completed his second presidential term. Most politicians and analysts assumed Kasyanov's replacement would be Putin's choice as political heir, as Putin had ultimately become Yeltsin's, but they misunderstood Putin's intentions. He did not want to name an heir apparent who might emerge as a political figure in his own right. Doing so would create the idea of a Russia without Putin, and it was far too early to contemplate that. Putin waited a week to let the mystery and suspense deepen. Speculation focused on the camps in Putin's Kremlin, the liberals and the Siloviki, led respectively by Alexei Kudrin and Sergei Ivanov, who had their own aspirations to ride Putin's coattails to power. Instead, he announced a nominee that no one predicted, not even those within the rival factions. The political elite were stirred, the journalist Anna Politkovskaya wrote. The guessing game about whom Putin would appoint took over the television channels. The political pundits were given something to discuss, and the press finally got something it could write about the election campaign. Less than 2 weeks before Election Day, meeting with parliamentary leaders to create the appearance of consultation as nominally required by the Constitution, Putin proclaimed that the new prime minister would be Mikhail Fradkov. There was a silence, one of the meeting participants told the newspaper Vedomosti, because some of us could not remember who Fradkov was. Fradkov, a balding, jowly bureaucrat, had a long, obscure career that began in the Soviet Ministry of Foreign Economic Affairs. He had no patron, no political constituency, no policy proposals that anyone could discern. He seemed as bland a choice for prime minister as Putin had been in 1999. Even Fradkov seemed stunned. Putin had first called him over the weekend, and he was still in Brussels, where he served as Russia's envoy to the European Union, when Putin made the announcement. When he arrived back in Moscow the next day, he admitted he had little qualification or vision for the post. He did not have to. If Putin really meant the appointment to clarify the next government's course, it signaled nothing except that a cabinet of ministers under Fradkov's command would be as pliant as the Duma and the Federation Council had become. Fradkov had no personal ambition, but rather belonged to the cadre of former intelligence officers Putin assembled in Moscow during his presidency. Fradkov's scientific education at the Moscow Machine and Tool Design Institute, a mysterious gap in his resume, his fluency in English and Spanish, and an assignment in the 1970s as an economic advisor in the Soviet Union's embassy in India, strongly suggested ties to the KGB. The fact that he never acknowledged or denied it suggested only that he operated undercover, as many Soviet trade officials did. In his announcement, Putin merely said that Fradkov was a good administrator who had experience in the security services. Throughout his first term, Putin had favored the security men in his appointments, by some estimates filling as many as 70% of senior government positions with former military, police, or intelligence officers, many of whom had the same background in the KGB. Fradkov fit the pattern. What few realized was that Putin had known Fradkov, this bland, unprepossessing apparatchik, for years. He had served as the Petersburg representative of the Foreign Trade Ministry in the early 1990s, and with his boss, Pyotr Avon, now one of Russia's richest bankers, had approved the barter contracts Putin had signed in the scandalous scheme to provide the city with food in the first winter of the new Russia. Kazyanov, and before him Voloshin, had represented a legacy of the Yeltsin years. Officials with their own ambitions, interests, and constituencies, they were now gone. There were still rivalries and divisions inside the Kremlin, but with Fradkov's appointment, Putin consolidated his political supremacy by elevating a complete network of underlings that would above all remain loyal to him. A mere 5 days after the appointment, the Duma confirmed Fradkov's nomination after a perfunctory debate that included only 9 questions. Fradkov offered only the vaguest platitudes about his policies. He was there to do Putin's bidding, and everyone understood it. The vote was 352-58, with 24 abstentions. Putin's re-election followed the script that Surkov's political team had written for it. He won more than 71% of the vote. The little-known communist candidate Nikolai Kharitonov came in a distant second with 13%. There was ample evidence of ballot stuffing and suspicious tallying, but the Kremlin blocked investigation of the accusations. In several regions, the turnout and Putin's total were incredible. In war-ravaged Chechnya, 92% voted for Putin. "I guess only Maskhadov and Basayev did not go to the polls," Kharitonov quipped, complaining bitterly about electoral irregularities, including instances of votes cast for him being counted for Putin. All across the Northern Caucasus, the regions conquered by Imperial Russia in the 18th and 19th centuries, similar results were delivered to Moscow like tributes to a czar. In Dagestan, 94% voted for Putin. In Kabardino-Bulgaria, 96. In Ingushetia, 98. In some districts across the country, the turnout and the votes for Putin exceeded 99.9%. And yet no one in the Kremlin, or beyond, seemed particularly embarrassed about it. The only drama of the night had nothing to do with the election. Only minutes after the polls closed in Moscow, a fire started in the Manezh, a neoclassical landmark across the Alexander Gardens from the Kremlin. The fire spread quickly through the wooden rafters of the roof and soon consumed the entire building. The first images broadcast on television made it appear that the Kremlin itself was on fire. Not something the authorities would like Russians to see on the day of Vladimir Putin's triumph, as one newspaper wrote. Putin watched from the roof of the Senate, the presidential office building inside the Kremlin. He had to postpone his victory speech, and even so, the state channels could not avoid showing the fire in the background during their live reports from the city's center. When the building's roof collapsed in an exploding heap, sending embers into the sky like an unwanted fireworks display, the crowd on the street inexplicably burst into cheers. 2 firefighters died when the burning rafters fell in on them. Officials blamed faulty wiring, or perhaps a welder's spark, but since no one had been working there on a Sunday night, the suspicion of arson lingered and was never fully dispelled. In a deeply superstitious culture, the fire seemed a dark omen. "I promise that the democratic accomplishments of our people will be unconditionally defended and guaranteed," Putin said when he finally made a brief appearance at his campaign headquarters on election night, dressed in a black turtleneck sweater. There was no victory party or celebration. No one seemed particularly excited. On the morning after his re-election, Putin received congratulatory telephone calls from George Bush, Tony Blair, Jacques Chirac, Gerhard Schroeder, and Junichiro Koizumi. Even as the international observers from the Organization for Security Cooperation in Europe gathered for the now ritual post-election news conference and declared that the election reflected the lack of a democratic culture, accountability, and responsibility. Putin's re-election demoralized the country's Democrats. The collapse of the liberal parties that had begun with the parliamentary elections prompted soul-searching over what went wrong. One of the few independent liberals elected to the Duma in 2003, Vladimir Ryzhkov, who represented Barnul in Siberia, called it the liberal debacle. The country's Democrats, he argued, had been tarnished by the negative consequences of the Soviet collapse, the chaotic and criminal transition to pseudo-capitalism that left millions impoverished and pining for the stability of the Soviet state, if not its stifling ideological and economic stagnation. And Putin, who had worked for one of the country's first Democrats and was the heir to the man who led Russia in the 1990s, somehow received all the credit for the economic recovery and the personal freedoms that still remained. Ryzhkov went on to lament that most of the Democratic supporters of the liberal parties, Yabloko and the Union of Right Forces, had voted not for their party leaders, but rather for Putin, whom the party leaders blamed for stripping the election and the system itself of any real democratic character. In the eyes of the majority of Russians, the country's number one Democrat is none other than President Vladimir Putin himself. The most striking remonstrance, however, came from an unexpected quarter, the cramped prison cell of Mikhail Khodorkovsky. He had been incarcerated for 5 months already, meeting with his lawyers and poring through the hundreds of pages of documents the prosecutors had assembled for his coming trial. He had made only brief remarks at his intermittent court hearings, but he spent the hours in his cell contemplating the evolution of politics and business in Russia. He had invested his personal fortune bankrolling politicians who had now been routed in parliamentary and presidential elections by the man he had tried, audaciously, he now understood, to challenge. From notes cobbled together with his lawyers, he published a lengthy treatise in the newspaper Viedomosti after Putin's re-election. It was part prescription and part confession, a biting analysis of the sins of Russia's liberals, himself included. Big business had pursued profit above the social good. It had perverted politics by sidling up to political power and lying about it to the people. The liberal champions of democracy had paid attention to 10% of the population and neglected those who suffered. Today, we are witnessing the virtual capitulation of the liberals. And that capitulation, indeed, is not only the liberals' fault, but also their problem. It is their fear in the face of a thousand-year history mixed with the strong liking for household comforts they developed in the 1990s. It is their servility ingrained on the genetic level, their readiness to ignore the Constitution for the sake of another helping of sturgeon. He atoned for his own role as a financial sponsor of Yeltsin's re-election in 1996 and the monstrous effect it took to make the Russian people choose with their hearts. Khodorkovsky's letter sounded like a jailhouse act of contrition, a plea for leniency or clemency. It was also an acute analysis of Russia's politics and society. Putin, he wrote, is probably neither a liberal nor a democrat, but he is still more liberal and democratic than 70% of our country's population. The man who jailed him was the man who would preserve the country until society developed a greater sense of unity, communality, and equality. Khodorkovsky singled out one opposition candidate, Irina Kakamada, for suggesting in a full-page newspaper advertisement that Putin had been responsible for the Nord-Ost siege. "We must give up the useless attempts to call the president's legitimacy into question. Regardless of whether we like Vladimir Putin or not, it's time to realize that the head of state is not just a private person. The president is an institution guaranteeing a nation's stability and integrity. And God forbid that we live to see a day when this institution collapses. Russia will not survive another February 1917. The nation's history tells us that a bad government is better than no government at all." September 1st is, by tradition, the first day of school across Russia, a ceremonial occasion called the Day of Knowledge. Parents and grandparents join their children as they assemble at their schools, everyone wearing their best clothes and carrying flowers or other presents to their new teachers. In the waning days of the summer of 2004, the celebrations once again took place across the country, including at school number one in Beslan, a small city in North Ossetia, a predominantly Orthodox region in the center of the Caucasus. More than 1,200 people had gathered in the school's courtyard at 9 o'clock in the morning when a military truck appeared and uniformed men leapt from beneath a tarp that covered the cargo bed. They fired rifles in the air and shouted, "Allahu Akbar!" The gunmen herded everyone first into a courtyard and then into the school's gymnasium, which they wired with bombs they hung above their hostages. Among the camouflaged men were two women, the roommates from Grozny who had been linked to the earlier attacks on the airplanes and the metro in Moscow, Maryam Taburova and Rosa Nageeva. They were now part of a terrorist attack as barbarous as the Nord-Ost siege nearly 2 years before. The Kremlin's strategy in Chechnya had suffered one setback after another. On May 9, 2004, 2 days after Putin's subdued second inauguration, a bomb secretly cemented into a pillar at Grozny's newly rebuilt soccer stadium exploded as the republic's political elite assembled for a Victory Day parade, commemorating the 59th anniversary of the Nazi defeat. The blast killed 13 people, including the newly installed president, Akhmad Kadyrov. Kadyrov, 52, had fought against the Russians in the first war in Chechnya, but he broke with the republic's president, Aslan Maskhadov, during its brief period of quasi-independence, opposed to the radicalized form of Islam that was taking root. As a mufti himself and a respected commander, Kadyrov had commanded enough respect to carry out Putin's plan to reunite Chechnya with the motherland. Now he was dead. In Chechnya's clannish society, the only obvious successor was his son, Ramzan, a thuggish fighter who had once served as his father's driver and then security chief, in charge of a group of fighters who became notorious for their brutal tactics against suspected militants. When Putin summoned Ramzan to the Kremlin on the day of his father's assassination, he arrived looking disheveled and wearing sweatpants. He was only 27, too young, according to Chechnya's new constitution, to become president, but Putin elevated him to the post of deputy prime minister and laid the foundation for him to succeed his father when he turned 30. The rebels vowed to kill him, too. "You don't have to be Nostradamus to guess the fate of Ramzan Kadyrov," they vowed on their website. 2 days after the attack in May, Putin secretly flew to Chechnya to attend Kadyrov's funeral, and his own delusion about the progress that had been made became clear. He flew by helicopter over the ruins of Grozny, seeing with his own eyes the physical evidence of devastation that had been airbrushed out of official accounts of the war. When he returned to Moscow, he appeared before his ministers and declared that not enough was being done to rebuild the shattered republic. He stated what had been obvious to anyone who had to live in Grozny. "Despite all that is being done there," he said, "it looks horrible from a helicopter." He sounded surprised. In Beslan, the local authorities were overwhelmed. Police commanders initially reported having trouble reaching the terrorists inside the school, even though one of them answered the school's telephone and told Nikolai Kalip of the New York Times that the fighters were a unit under the command of Shamil Basayev, Russia's most wanted terrorist. "Wipe your sniffles," he told Kalip. After a while, a terrified woman emerged from the school with a note demanding negotiations with the leaders of North Ossetia and neighboring Ingushetia, and the doctor who had mediated during the Nord-Ost siege, Leonid Roshal. The note also warned that the captors would shoot 50 hostages if any of their fighters were killed. By evening, they escorted the men to a classroom on the second floor and began to execute them one by one anyway, heaving their bodies out the window. On the morning the siege began, Putin woke and managed an early swim in the sea, but the unfolding crisis made staying in Sochi impossible. He flew back to Moscow, where a senior aide who met him described him as terribly upset, complaining about the utter breakdown in security that could allow a group of heavily armed fighters to seize an entire school. Putin remained in the Kremlin during the following days, retreating periodically to the office's chapel to pray, it was made known, but also complaining that he did not have time for his daily exercise routine. He appeared in public only briefly, on September 2nd, during an appearance with King Abdullah of Jordan, in which he vowed to protect the lives of the hostages above all. He spoke even as he ordered the FSB to dispatch 10 special-purpose groups to Beslan, each comprising elite officers trained for extraordinary crises. Putin sought to convey a sense of calm authority, but the reflex of Russian officials to lie in the face of tragedy compounded the sense of panic and chaos. The authorities in Beslan and in Moscow reported that there were only 354 hostages, even though everyone in the town knew there were more. Some of those outside the school angrily resorted to holding up signs in view of television cameras, saying there were as many as 800 hostages, and imploring Putin to intervene peacefully, knowing that would not be his reflexive instinct. The terrorists inside were furious when they watched state television, parroting the lie about the number of hostages. They threatened to shoot hostages until only 354 were left. Even some officials agonized over the lies they had to repeat. The authorities, the police, the Interior Ministry, and the FSB, all bolstered by Putin during his first term, seemed paralyzed. They worried as much about protecting the regime that Putin had created as about protecting the children and parents besieged inside the school. Anna Politkovskaya, who had negotiated with the terrorists at Nord-Ost, reached out to Chechnya's opposition leaders in exile to mediate again. But when she flew to an airport near enough to drive to Beslan, she fell ill during the flight. She was convinced that the tea she had been given was poisoned. Andrei Babitsky, the reporter whose capture during the early years of the war had led to a scandal, was detained at a Moscow airport as well. The authorities, who had failed spectacularly to protect Beslan's school, were determined to protect the city from unwanted reporters. The officials in Beslan appeared uncertain and hesitant as the siege entered a second day. The tension was heightened by intermittent explosions and gunfire, the cause of which remained unclear to those outside. Putin had made himself the ultimate authority in Russia, but his vertical of power created paralysis in times of crisis. No one would risk taking an initiative that might provoke disapproval. Putin had vowed never to negotiate with terrorists, but for the first time, he allowed his aides to explore the possibility of a negotiated end to the siege, even as the Kremlin distanced him from the effort. He instructed the region's governor, Alexander Zatsakov, to make contact with Aslan Maschadov's chief representative in exile, Ahmed Zakayev. He did so through Ruslan Aushev, the former president of neighboring Ingushetia. Aushev, a hero of the Soviet war in Afghanistan, had been sympathetic to Chechnya's struggle for independence, but he also made sure to keep his region out of the fighting. Aushev arrived in Beslan on the second day of the siege and took over contact with the terrorists. Within 15 minutes, he was told he could enter the school, the first official allowed in. What he saw inside was desperate. The terrorists had given the hostages no food or water. The commander of the group, who called himself Colonel, gave Aushev a handwritten list of demands. Russian troops should withdraw from Chechnya and grant it independence. The new Chechnya would join Russia in the Commonwealth of Independent States, keep the ruble as its currency, and work with Russian forces to restore order in the region. The note, scrawled on notebook paper, was addressed to His Excellency, President of the Russian Federation, and written in the name of the servant of Allah, Shamil Basayev. None of the demands would be acceptable to Putin, but Aushev promised to convey them if the terrorists would release the women with nursing babies. One of the terrorists told him there were 1,020 hostages inside the sweltering school. Aushev managed to persuade them to allow 26 hostages to leave with him, 11 women and 15 babies. When Alshev returned to the command center, he called Zakayev, then in London. Zakayev told him that he and Maschadov were prepared to assist, but that if Maschadov were to travel to Beslan to speak to the terrorists, Russia would have to guarantee safe passage. Alshev knew that a plan had been drawn up to raid the school. In fact, two of the special units that Putin had ordered to Beslan were already training for an assault at a similar schoolhouse not far away. He hoped he could win the release of more hostages in the meantime, however. On the morning of the third day, September 3rd, he reached an agreement with the terrorists to remove the bodies of the men who had been executed and tossed from the classroom window. By then, their corpses had begun decomposing. A four-man crew from the Ministry of Emergency Situations pulled up in an ambulance at 1 o'clock and had just begun picking up the bodies when a thunderous explosion rocked the school's gymnasium. 22 seconds later, a second explosion erupted. The blasts lifted the roof and rafters off the school, blew out the windows, and ripped a hole in the gymnasium's wall. Scores were killed immediately, but dazed survivors began to escape, tumbling out of the shattered school. The soldiers outside and the terrorists inside, both unsure of what had happened, began a ferocious firefight that lasted for 10 hours. The roof caught fire, and the burning rafters collapsed on those still inside. A conspiracy theory later emerged that the Russians had started the battle by firing into the school, but none of those outside had appeared prepared to launch an assault on the building when the assault began. Many did not have bulletproof vests, nor had they established a security perimeter around the building. There were no ambulances or fire trucks on hand. Local men with hunting rifles joined the fight, firing haphazardly and running into the crossfire to carry children to safety. The horrific pandemonium unfolded live on international television, though not on the Russian networks, which interrupted their regular programming only for brief updates that continued to play down the carnage as it worsened. Neither Putin nor any other senior officials emerged to address the crisis. Prime Minister Fradkov carried on with a government meeting convened to discuss the nation's privatization plans, even as the bursts of gunfire and explosions shredded the school. The climax of the battle came that night at 11:15, when a Russian tank fired a shell into the school, killing three insurgents holding out in the basement. Russia's state television networks had declared the situation under control hours before. When it was over, 334 hostages had died, 186 of them children. 10 Russian commandos were killed trying to free those inside. 30 terrorists died, including the two women, Maryam Taburova and Rosa Nageyeva, whose roommates had launched the wave of terror by destroying the two airliners. One terrorist was captured and later tried in court, but others were believed to have escaped in the chaos. Since the death toll nearly equaled the number of hostages that had been repeated for more than 2 days on state television, the lie could no longer be hidden. The public distrust of official statements was such that many believed the government continued to lie about the number of dead, the fate of the terrorists, and the cause of the two explosions that had brought the siege to its horrible end. Putin left the Kremlin early on the morning of September 4th and flew to Beslan. He arrived before dawn and visited the wounded in a hospital before making a brief statement with the region's president, Alexander Tsatsikov. "Today, all of Russia suffers for you," he told him. He offered no other words of comfort beyond his vow to hunt down those responsible for the siege. He was not there to comfort, but to create the image of having comforted. He did not hold a meeting, even one scripted for the cameras, with the people of Beslan. The anguished, frenzied, and traumatized crowds that had kept vigil outside the school demanded afterward that the government act, that the government stop lying. Instead, Putin returned to Moscow and delivered a televised address to the nation. When Putin appeared in the nation's living rooms that night, he looked uncharacteristically shaken. he stood alone in front of a wood-paneled wall and a Russian flag. "It is a difficult and bitter task for me to speak," he began. "A horrible tragedy happened in our land." He asked all of Russia to remember those who lost the dearest in their life, bowing his head slightly, but he offered no apology and accepted no responsibility. He did not use the occasion to defend, justify, or explain his policies in Chechnya, nor did he offer any new approach. He did not even mention Chechnya by name. Putin instead offered a soliloquy on the country's history, one with a deep nostalgia for the unifying purpose and security of the Soviet Union, then already 13 years gone. He had only suggested as much before, careful to honor the history of the Soviet past without embracing its failures and crimes, but now he seemed to blame the siege in Beslan on Russia's inability to preserve the strength that made the Soviet Union he remembered as a boy so strong and respected. "There have been many tragic pages and difficult trials in the history of Russia," he went on, lecturing patiently as a professor might. "Today, we are living in conditions formed after the disintegration of a huge, great country, the country which unfortunately turned out to be non-viable in the conditions of a rapidly changing world. Today, however, despite all difficulties, we managed to preserve the nucleus of that giant, the Soviet Union. We called the new country the Russian Federation. We all expected changes, changes for the better, but found ourselves absolutely unprepared for much that changed in our lives. The question is why? We live in conditions of a transitional economy and a political system that do not correspond to the development of society. We live in conditions of aggravated internal conflicts and ethnic conflicts that before were harshly suppressed by the governing ideology. We stopped paying due attention to issues of defense and security. We allowed corruption to affect the judiciary and law enforcement systems. In addition to that, our country, which once had one of the mightiest systems of protecting its borders, suddenly found itself unprotected either from west or east." Putin's remarks sounded almost like an indictment of his first years in office, a recognition that he had failed to deliver on the promises he had made over and over. The reference to Russia's unprotected borders revealed a blinkered understanding of the threat still emanating from Chechnya. He had long sought to link the war to the rise of Al-Qaeda globally, but despite a shared ideology of extremist Islam, the terrorism Russia faced was largely grown at home. Its roots reached back to the Tsarist conquest of the Caucasus in the 19th century. Yet he believed that those who attacked the school had help from nations determined to punish Russia, to keep it weak and pliant. His tone was apocalyptic and defiant. He said the country had to unite to preserve its very existence. "Some want to tear off of us a juicy piece of pie," he said. "Others help them to do it. They help because they think that Russia, as one of the greatest nuclear powers of the world, is still a threat, and this threat has to be eliminated. And terrorism is only an instrument to achieve these goals." Putin spoke as if he had experienced a great revelation, yet the war on terrorism was the one place where he had found common ground with world leaders. Despite occasional rebukes for the brutality of Russian tactics in Chechnya, no leader ever expressed sympathy for the terrorist tactics of Basayev and his followers. The only government that ever recognized Chechnya's declaration of independence after the first war was the Taliban in Afghanistan, who the United States, with Russia's blessing and assistance, had helped overthrow after the attacks of September 11, 2001. But now Putin blamed unseen enemies for abetting one of the most heinous terrorist acts in history. The country had grown lax and lazy in the face of this external threat, he said, and he vowed to take every possible measure to strengthen the state. We demonstrated weakness, he said, and the weak are beaten. The reforms that Putin promised in his national address after the Beslan tragedy were not long in coming. He did not shake up the intelligence services that had failed to anticipate the attack on a school. He did not fire the military or police commanders who had botched the attempted negotiations and the ultimate rescue. Instead, Putin announced that he would tighten the Kremlin's political control by further dismantling the vestiges of democratic government. On September 13th, 10 days after the horrifying end of the siege, Putin abolished the elections of governors, mayors, and presidents of Russia's many regions and republics, who since the collapse of the Soviet Union had maintained their own constituencies and power bases outside of Moscow's direct control. He would now appoint them and submit his candidates to the regional parliaments for ratification. If they rejected his candidates, he could then disband them. He also abolished the representative district elections for the parliament, which accounted for half of the Duma's 450 seats. With opposition parties increasingly circumscribed, these elections provided the only independent and liberal members left in power after the 2003 elections. The proposals shocked those who felt that for all of Putin's authoritarian instincts, the country was nonetheless making steady, if halting, progress toward democracy. Izvestia called it the September Revolution, while Putin's critics denounced the moves as unconstitutional, even though they were resigned to the futility of any legal challenge. The most prominent criticism came from Boris Yeltsin. In an interview with Moskovsky Novosti, he recalled his promise to remain out of the nation's political debates in retirement, but said Beslan had been a watershed that had made Russia a different country. We will not permit ourselves to renounce the letter and, most importantly, the spirit of the constitution that the country adopted at a nationwide referendum in 1993, if only because strangling freedoms and curtailing democratic rights marks, among other things, the victory of terrorists. Privately, Yeltsin despaired over the leader he had elevated to power, seeing Putin's moves against the media, against opposition parties, and now against the governors as an erosion of his own legacy. But the interview was the only time Yeltsin had voiced his concerns so sharply in public. By now, though, Yeltsin's moral and political authority had little force in Putin's Russia. His time had passed, and his heir was taking the country on a new path. Indeed, the Yeltsin era, the erratic lurch through the chaos of the 1990s, had become Putin's recurring justification for his decisions. Step by step, Putin erased the legacy of his predecessor, as surely as Stalin had Lenin's, as Khrushchev had Stalin's, as Brezhnev had Khrushchev's, as Yeltsin had Gorbachev's. Even those most affected by Putin's new decree, the governors and mayors, who owed their electoral legitimacy and authority to the ballot box, however compromised, stepped forward one by one to praise Putin's proposal. The proposals had been debated before in his administration, but he used the Beslan tragedy as the pretext to implement them. Popular will, in Putin's view, was the road to chaos. The people could not be entrusted with the power to choose their own leaders except in the most carefully controlled process. The Russian people are backward, he would later tell a group of foreign journalists and academics invited to a retreat that would become an annual affair known as the Valdai Club, after the resort where it was first held. They cannot adapt to democracy as they have done in your countries. They need time. His remarks reflected condescension that bordered on disdain, but few in Russia spoke up to challenge the authority he now took upon himself. Within weeks, the Duma and the Federation Council enacted all of his proposals, willingly handing more and more powers to the Kremlin. The only thing left is absolute prostration, Leonid Dobrokhotov, an advisor to the communists, said in response. And most of Russia's elite, either from loyalty or from fear, were happy to oblige.